The vast majority of Americans have never really met the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. They've only heard what his enemies have said about him. And you can never rely on your enemy to give you an objective, unprejudiced, disinterested account of anything. The Western Orientalists have vilified the Holy Prophet for hundreds of years. Montgomery Watt says, of all the world's great men, none has been so much maligned as Muhammad, end quote. Yet the Prophet's message continues to resonate in the hearts of the faithful, and Islam continues to grow. How? Because God tells the Prophet in the Quran, Wallahu ya'asimuka minan nas, and God will defend and protect you from the violence and slanders of men. The Prophet's defense counsel is God himself.
Welcome to Reasonable Faith, Conversations with William Lane Craig. I'm Kevin Harris, and we hope you'll find the topics we discuss enriching and enlightening concerning the big questions of life. Dr. William Lane Craig is a noted philosopher and theologian known for his work on the existence of God, philosophy of time, and the resurrection of Jesus. And we invite you to discover the wealth of resources at reasonablefaith.org. There you'll find Dr. Craig's famous debates with leading atheists, articles, books, podcasts, audio from Dr. Craig's Defenders class, and a question and answer section featuring amazing questions people send us and answers from Dr. Craig. That's reasonablefaith.org. reasonablefaith.org. Dr. Craig, from time to time, we get some questions at reasonablefaith.org on world religions, the Muslims, the Hindu faith, and so on. We have some questions on Islam here that we thought you could address. And basically, this listener writes that he's engaged with a Muslim, and the Muslim is using his own apologetics against him, and he's having a difficult time answering them. Now, this brings up a question here, and the question is along the lines of, well, everybody has their own apologetics. Everybody defends. Everybody's an apologist, you know, for something, in a sense. While it is mostly related to the Christian faith historically, perhaps our Muslim friends have kind of taken a cue from us in defending their faith as well.
Well, I think that is true. On the contemporary scene, Muslim apologists have definitely been influenced by Christian thinkers. And I know this is the case because I've talked to them. Shabir Ali, a Canadian Muslim apologist who is the head of the Dawah Center, which is an apologetics ministry for Islam out of Toronto, has said, I have listened to all of your tapes. I use your Kalam cosmological argument all the time in my debates with atheists. So these folks have definitely taken a cue from what Christian thinkers are doing.
Absolutely. In fact, I've heard some atheist debaters actually use your very language and your techniques in their debates with theists from studying yours. And so,
goodness, that's really unfortunate.
Not in any significant sense, just in saying things like I'm presenting a cumulative case and some things like that. But methodology aside, we're still going to try to get to the content. It's still going to be, is what you're defending true, and are there persuasive reasons for it? First off, this Muslim asked, how can you believe in a God that would incarnate and have a son when God is just strictly one? He's monotheistic. So it seems to be the tact here is to reduce the Christian's view to an absurdity by saying, how can you believe such an absurdity as the eternal God being able to incarnate?
Well, I think that the Muslim regards this as blasphemous. This is the central sin, according to Islam, is to associate anything with God. God, on Islamic theology, is without a peer. And therefore, to say that God could have a son is blasphemous because it associates something else with God. Unfortunately, I think that Islam has largely misunderstood the Christian doctrine of the Trinity. According to the Christian doctrine of the Trinity, it's not as though we are associating something that is not God with God as his equal. Rather, the claim is that God himself is tri-personal, that instead of one center of self-consciousness and will, in God there are three centers of self-consciousness and will. So God is three persons. He is tri-personal. And the incarnation is that one of those persons assumed or took on a human nature in addition to his divine nature. Now, in so doing, he did not subtract any of the properties of the divine nature. He didn't give up omnipotence or necessity or eternality or moral perfection. But he took on, in addition to those divine properties that he has, a set of human properties typically associated with a human body. So that the second person of the Trinity, whom we call Jesus, had two natures in the incarnation. He had a divine nature, which is fully God, and then he had a human nature, which is fully human. And the doctrine of the incarnation is therefore not that God somehow turned himself into a human being. That would indeed be absurd. But it is simply that God, the second person of the Trinity, in addition to the divine nature he has eternally had, took on a human nature in addition to that. And I see nothing logically incoherent or blasphemous about that. In fact, if God is omnipotent, as Islam affirms, then why couldn't God do this?
The second line of argument that the writer's Muslim friend says is that one of the evidences for the authenticity of the Quran is that Muhammad was illiterate and therefore could not have written a work like the Noble Quran.
Uh-huh. We don't really know that Muhammad was, in fact, illiterate. As a merchant, he probably had to do transactions. He probably had to engage in record keeping and so forth. And in any case, we don't really know that the Quran was written exclusively by Muhammad. The earliest biography of Muhammad comes about a century and a half after his death. And a good many scholars think that the Quran is, in fact, a compilation of both early and late traditions that post-date Muhammad's death. So we have no real grounds for knowing either that he was illiterate or that, in fact, he did write the Quran as it stands today. So this is just a typical kind of Islamic or Muslim line that Muslims are taught. This is the standard apologetic, is that the Quran itself is unparalleled in its beauty and elegance, and no human being can reproduce it, and no illiterate man could have written it. But in fact, there really isn't any basis for thinking that he was illiterate or that he did write it all.
Yeah, I think that calling something beautiful and flowing and well-written is not a good apologetic defense, in that so many works are, that are not obviously just divine, are considered to be inspired, and yet they're beautiful and they have prose.
Yeah, I don't think this is really a good argument at all, but it's just been ingrained into Muslims. They've been taught this. They've been told this. Even Muslims who can't read Arabic because they're not from Arab countries and can't even read the Quran have been told this. In fact, I remember reading a comment by Gerd Puin, who is an Islamicist, a German scholar. He says that fully 20% of the Quran is simply unintelligible. That the reason it cannot be translated is because we don't even know what it means. This is in ancient Arabic, you know, from the 7th century. It is often difficult to know what the text originally said because it does get corrupted as it's copied, despite what Muslims say about this. And he would say that 20% of the Quran is just unintelligible. Well, that kind of evacuates this argument based upon the impossibility of its being written by Muhammad of any, I think, persuasive power.
The next apologetic that this Muslim offers to our friend here is that the Quran condemns Muhammad himself. And so that lends to the authenticity of Muhammad's sincerity while writing it. It seems to take a page out of Christian apologetics and saying that the disciples were cowards. Just tells it exactly the way it is, and that lends to its authenticity.
This is called the criterion of embarrassment in New Testament studies or historical Jesus studies, and I think that it is valid when you apply it to that. But I don't think anybody's claiming that Muhammad didn't really believe these things or that he was insincere, so I guess I don't see this as establishing anything of any significance. Those passages in the Quran that would put Muhammad in a bad light or
say that his sins needed to be forgiven.
Right, that would minimize him. I, I don't see that proves anything other than just, as the writer said, his sincerity.
Certainly one could be just humble and write about himself in a deprecating way.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
an attempt at humility or whatever.
Sure.
Next line of argument would be that there are prophecies that the Quran has that have been fulfilled, thus demonstrating it. I don't know of any examples here, and they weren't offered in this letter. So.
Right. The prophecies that I'm typically aware of is the claim that the life of Muhammad fulfills prophecies that were made earlier, like in the Gospels, that Jesus' prophecy of another comforter who will come, referring to the Holy Spirit, that this really means Muhammad and so forth. And this is just based on misexegesis of these texts, misinterpretations. There's no grounds for thinking that these were prophecies about Muhammad and his life or of Islam. And I'm not aware of any predictions in the Quran itself that have been verified or fulfilled.
Let me ask you about some tactics with our Muslim friends, and that is, do you think that if we can emphasize what you did at the beginning of this broadcast, that we both believe, Muslims and Christians, believe that there is only one God, that that may soften their ear and knock some defenses down to where they will listen further?
I would hope so. I think we need to try to find as much common ground with them as we can. I remember talking to one Muslim who was astounded to find out that I believed in the existence of angels. And he said, my heart is pounding as I talk to you. He was so thrilled to think that I, as a Christian, would also believe that there are angels of God. And so I thought, gosh, to me, it seemed like a kind of trivial point, but for him, it was common ground. And so we should try to find, I think, these areas where we can, that we both believe that there is one God and that he is omnipotent and omniscient and wholly good, and that there will be a judgment day, that people will be held accountable for their sins and so forth. There is a lot of commonality along with the error in Islam.
Would it be productive to perhaps point out that there was a misunderstanding of the Trinity at the time of the writing of the Quran? I mean, I know that that sends dispersions upon the writing of the Quran and the accuracy theologically of Muhammad and so forth, but there was a misunderstanding. They thought it what? That it included Mary?
Yes, yeah. There are passages in the Quran where God says to Jesus, did you ever say, worship me and my mother as gods? And Jesus says, far be it from me to say such a thing. I only told them what you told me, worship God, the one true God. And here, Muhammad evidently thought that the Trinity was composed of God the Father, Mary, and Jesus, their offspring, which is a blasphemous doctrine that any Christian would reject. So, of course, Muhammad was right in regarding this as a horrible doctrine that he would reject, because we would too. And I think we need to share that with Muslims to help them understand what we really do believe, that in fact we don't believe anything like this misconstruction of the doctrine of the Trinity that is condemned rightly in the Quran.
I've got to tell you what happened to me, Dr. Craig. I was invited by a Muslim into a voice chat room where you can go in and you can type text and you can also talk on a mic when it's your turn. And so I did go in, and I rather relished the opportunity to share the Lord. Let me offer this warning right now. There's been at least one case from this very chat room where a person was tracked down and physically attacked.
Oh, my.
Because of a skirmish that broke out in the chat room. So while my anonymity was pretty intact, it can be rather intimidating nonetheless.
Yes.
So I went into the room. I knew that it was not going to be fair or anything like that, but, you know, I often try to plant some seeds. Went in, and this is what the administrator of the room said. I want you to read the first few verses of the Song of Solomon. Will you do that for us? And I want everyone, it was mostly Muslims in the room, in fact, they were from the Mideast, I want you to listen. And I said, certainly I will. And I began to read. Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, for your love is more delightful than wine. Pleasing is the fragrance of your perfumes. Your name is like perfume poured out. No wonder the maidens love you. And immediately, they turned my mic off, and the administrator came back on. I guess my will, they, the administrator can do that. Turn my mic off, and he came back on, and he says, "Does everyone hear the filth of this, of these scriptures?" And they claim that this is the word of God. Can everyone hear filthiness here?
Yeah.
He said, I would like to ask you this now. You know,
I'll bet privately all of these Muslim men went out and read that afterwards.
Yeah, read it afterwards. I hope they did, yeah. So they said, let me ask you a question. Do you believe that Jesus was both God and man? They gave me my mic back. And I said, well, first of all, let me comment on Song of Solomon. And this is a celebration of human love, and I think it's very appropriate. And there's nothing dirty or nasty about this. Turned my mic off and said, answer my question. Was God both man? You've already offended all the ladies in the room.
Oh,
he said, answer my question. Was God both, with Jesus, both God and man? And I said, yes. And I began to try to break down the doctrine of the hypostatic union. They cut my mic again and said, ladies and gentlemen, this Christian believes that God went to the toilet. Because if Jesus was a man, then he went to the toilet. And all of a sudden in text, it came up, kick him out, kick him out, kick him out. And they kicked me out of the room.
Gosh. Yeah.
Well, I expected that, Bill. But it showed a sensitivity to a sexuality, human love, and so forth in the Song of Songs, of all things. And such a repulsion of going to the bathroom.
Yes, right. That's unclean.
Yeah. And how can Jesus, being God, have done that?
Yeah.
So do you see the barrier?
Yeah, they're huge barriers, aren't they? I mean, to try to reach people like that. Though I must say, I'm surprised about the Song of Solomon, because albeit this is an erotic love poem, nevertheless, as you say, it's perfectly appropriate between a man and his wife.
Mm-hmm.
For this sort of erotic love to be expressed. And I would think that Muslims who pride themselves, you know, on being masculine and virile and so forth would like the Song of Solomon. They are very proud that Muhammad had all these wives and was able to satisfy them all. And they see nothing wrong with him taking this young girl that he did to be one of his wives. So I'm puzzled at that, though. The one about the toilet, you can understand a revulsion with something that was unclean, that they wouldn't want to associate anything like God with that. But there's just a closed-mindedness there to understanding the difference between the humanity of Christ and the deity of Christ.
It's also taking kind of a low view of the body.
Yes.
I don't think our digestive system is a curse, necessarily.
I
know the fall affects us, but God designed us
a
certain way. I mean, why take such a low? That's kind of crazy.
Yeah, well, I think, again, it has to do with cultural perceptions of what's clean and unclean. And in some of these countries, for example, you would never shake hands or touch someone's left hand because this is the hand they would use to wipe themselves with, you know, after defecating. So this would just be regarded as repulsive. And the idea that this could be associated with God would be anathema to folks like that. So these are big, big cultural barriers to surmount. And I mean that this isn't an intellectual objection, is it? These are just emotional hot buttons that this person was pressing.
So the emotional hot buttons can often be a real barrier to truth. And sometimes we have to get down to an emotional level, it seems, to try to get around it. I mean,
probably people like this aren't going to be persuaded probably by rational argumentation. That they're going to be persuaded by your taking an interest in them personally, becoming their friend and really caring about them as people, and beginning to break down those kinds of barriers. It's in cases like this that I think real friendship evangelism probably is the best route to go.
Thank you, Dr. Craig, for spending some time with us, and thank you, the listener, for being here today. This podcast is available at reasonablefaith.org, as well as a wealth of audio, video, and written materials from William Lane Craig. People all over the world have benefited from the insights of Dr. Craig, and we invite you to browse our resources at reasonablefaith.org. And when you give to Reasonable Faith or purchase our resources, you help us expand into more media and speaking events, taking Christ to a world of big questions. So be sure and visit us at reasonablefaith.org. I'm Kevin Harris. Thanks again for joining us, and we'll see you next time on Reasonable Faith with William Lane Craig.